Welcome to the Tampa St. Pete Sports Connection Radio Show, live from Ferd Sports Bar and Grill, providing a positive perspective from the peewees to the preps to the pros in Champa Bay. Now, here's your host, Mike Rickard.
Yeah. Who cares? I'm just kidding.
For my obnoxious chant.
Florida Southern.
Florida Southern. I gotta research them. I gotta get ready with my obnoxious chant.
The men's program actually comes out and supports us, and they do fantastic chants and cheers. Oh yeah. Fantastic environment.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a great environment. I appreciate you coming down, Coach. I'm glad you could finally get here.
I know, right?
I think I could have, she and I could go banter back and forth quite
for
a bit.
For sure. I was coming over the bridge. Oof. A lot of red in the strip there.
That bridge and the one over here, I took last night, I was on the one over here.
Yeah, Howard Franklin.
Oh, my God. I live right down here on the beach, and I'd like my little world. I can drive over with you guys. I'm on Sunset Beach.
Oh, nice.
Nice and close.
Nice.
Yeah, so maybe I should come practice and see if you...
You need to go on the boat ride with us next year.
You betcha. I'll be there. I'll line up the captain. We got a friend that's a captain. We'll make sure that Joey's in charge.
You
got
to get mic'd up.
Yeah, we'll get mic'd up. Mic'd up and life jacketed up. You're going to take swim lessons? What in the God's green earth? Grew up in Florida. No swim lessons. I want your mom to hear this, and we're going to get you in the pool. Get you in the pool. It's not too late to learn anything. All right, ladies, thank you very much for coming down.
This thank you so much for having us.
It's been an absolute blast. And stay in touch. Grab one of my cards here, Coach.
Okay. And go Tritons.
Go Tritons.
Yep.
And who cares? Playing the who cares this weekend. Thank you very much. That
absolutely.
Was a lot of
fun. Thank
that,
you.
That was a lot of fun.
So fun.
And for young ladies, they held their own without Coach here. They didn't need you.
I know. Why they'll even come. That's how it's supposed to be. Coach is only needed in certain...
Exactly. All right. Have a great weekend.
All right. Thanks. All right. Thanks, Mike.
All right. That was a lot of fun and a great story. I love doing the Triton time, as I call it. And I get the gals over here. Want me to? Here, I'll cover up.
No. We need your face. We need the radio.
This is why you got to love live radio. And here comes the my next guest. I got to get a picture with the beauties from Eckerd College. And this commercial timeout is brought to you by, all right, thank you very much, Ferg Sports Bar and Grill. And, of course, we are live. And Peter Gollenbach's going to sit down right now with me, and we're going to talk baseball. Well, who knows where we're going to go with this conversation. But I'm looking forward to it. And, of course, we're at Ferg Sports Bar and Grill in the heart of Champa Bay, where he's been for 29 years. Peter himself is here every Thursday playing a little trivia and lives in the neighborhood. And, as I said, any college game you want, today, come on down. There's 94 televisions, and Mark is he's very gracious. All of his managers, doesn't matter. As I said, you know, I was doing scores earlier. You would have been happy. So I'm doing the games that are going to be aired today, and you and your bride could have gone over and said, you know, we want to see who they're playing. I want Dartmouth and Penn.
Dartmouth and Penn would be great.
Yeah, Dartmouth and Penn. That'd be a great game for you to watch. You want to grab this mic, my friend?
You want me to wear this thing? No.
I just snapped myself off.
Oh, is Dartmouth playing Penn in basketball?
Yep, they're playing basketball.
All right.
And that's your alma mater, apparently.
You know, when I was a sophomore at Dartmouth, I was on the Dartmouth basketball team, and we played Bill Bradley. He was a senior. And Bill Bradley was the best basketball player I had ever seen.
Senator Bill Bradley.
Senator Bill Bradley, and they beat us 106-46.
Holy
and the next
moly.
Next time, they beat us 93-33.
Holy moly.
Holy moly.
God rest his soul. I think he passed.
No.
No, he didn't.
No, he's all right.
Who was I thinking? It was another New York Knick I watched in my youth.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it's great to have you down here. I've been reading your bio and very impressed. at our, and I've been down here helping Markov for 6 years. I can't believe our paths hadn't crossed. But when I called you, I'd seen your picture on the Facebook because you guys dominate in trivia.
I don't know if we dominate, but we do okay.
As I said in the intro, he's an accomplished author. I'll give you some of the books that he has penned. Of course, Bronx Zoo, the Oral History of the Brooklyn Dodgers, Seven, the Mickey Mantle novel, The Dynasty of the New York Yankees, 49-64. Personal. This is the one that was kind of interesting. We'll talk about it if you care to, since we're in the middle of basketball season.
Yeah.
Personal Falls, the NCAA, and Jimmy V. I really love the amazing, miraculous history of the New York Mets. In fact, one of those young ladies from New York, she's a Mets fan. That was kind of cool. I told her you were coming on. And then The Spirit of St. Louis, the history of the Cards, because right over here, one of the blocks, the Cards used to play spring ball right here in St. Peter.
For a long time.
Yeah. So you went to law school, New York University of Law. And did you have a passion your entire life growing up for sports?
I did. Certainly I did. I played it since I was a kid. I wrote about it in high school. I was a sports editor at Dartmouth, of the Dartmouth. I wrote, while I was at Dartmouth, I wrote Dartmouth Sports for the New York Times, for the Boston Globe. And when I was in law school, my friend was the sports editor of the Stanford Advocate. And he gave me press credentials to all of the sports, the Yankees, the Mets, the Rangers, the Knicks, and I wrote him for free articles every weekend.
Absolute home run for a young guy.
It was spectacular. Phil Jackson and I became the closest of friends. I spent the 3 years with the Knicks, won their championship in 70. They won again in 73, and I was there for all of that.
You know, I grew up in Sioux City, Iowa, which is 90 miles north of 90 miles north of Omaha, and I was always a Willis Reed fan.
Sure.
And I can remember, I'm 65, I'm a little younger than you, I can remember vividly when Willis Reed came out of the locker room, that inspirational, motivational appearance. And that was at home in the Garden, wasn't it?
It was, and he made his first two shots.
Yeah.
And that was enough for the Knicks to go on and win that game. It was spectacular. I was sitting in the press box that day.
Were you?
It was electric. It was spectacular.
And for those young listeners, but we typically have conversations like that, historical conversations, Phil Jackson, you just remember him as the Bulls and, of course, the Lakers' incredibly successful coach. But he was a mop-haired kid from North Dakota when he played for the Knicks, right?
He was. I had, at law school, I had a classmate of mine, Sally Gold, who had gone to the University of North Dakota. And she said to me, you know, I have a friend. I have a friend who I went to school with. You might like this guy. Oh, yeah? And who is that? His name is Phil Jackson. And he's here in the city. I said, yeah, he's here in the city, all right. He's playing for the Knicks. And she introduced the two of us. We had a great time.
So you had already met him. And who would think that you know two people that had gone to college, and I've been there many times, unfortunately, Grand Forks, North Dakota, the coldest spot in America.
Wow.
Yeah, that's very unusual. So you guys became close friends.
Yeah.
And
we did.
So you kept in contact through the Zen years and the triangle.
Well, we lost. You know, I moved on. He moved on, and we lost track of each other. When my son was 12, I called Pat Williams, who was the founder of the Orlando Magic, and I said, "Pat, son, to meet Phil and the Chicago Bulls. Can you arrange that for me?" And he said, "Of course." And so we went into the clubhouse during halftime. And you talk about large people. I mean, Phil's 6'8", and Michael Jordan was there, and all the rest of those championship Bulls. It was something to be with those people.
So you actually got to take your son into the locker room.
I did.
And the Bulls were there during that
era.
They
were there. That was the Bulls. Yes.
Now was Shaq with Orlando then? Shaquille O'Neal?
You know, he may well have been. But my focus, at the time was
Phil Jackson and the Bulls.
That's right.
For many reasons, and I was blessed to be able to sit six rows behind Phil Jackson at United Center, and I think it was 1998, and watch him at work with that incredible chemistry that they had with, you know. You had Pip, you had Jordan, you know, everybody knows Rodman. In fact, that particular that particular game, he launched his jersey. He got booted. He launched his jersey into the stands right over our heads. But and then he advanced to the L.A. Lakers, and that's all basketball history now. All right, let's go back to your growing up and then advancing into journalism and then the opportunity to cover the Yankees. That had to have been an absolute thrill for a young guy, and then write these incredible books that were
well
received.
It was something that you would have thought never should have happened, actually. When I was 10, 11, 12 years old, I was in the library, and I found a book called The New York Yankees by a writer by the name of Frank Graham. And I'm reading this book, and there's conversations with Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and Joe DiMaggio, and I was just totally enthralled. The Yankees, every year that I was a kid, won the pennant. If you remember, they won the pennant in 49, they won the pennant in 50, they won it in 51, 52, 53, 55, 56, 57, 58, 60, 61, 62, 63, and 64. That's 16 years, 14 pennants, 9 world championships. That was my childhood. So, after law school, I went to work for Prentice Hall, writing.
The publisher.
The publisher,
yeah.
Writing,
yeah.
President Nixon's wage and price controls.
That was your topic?
That was the topic. They would send the new rules, and I would put it into English and tell banks and tell other lawyers what the hell was going on.
It wasn't exactly your passion.
Not my passion. But during one lunch, I found a catalog of their trade books, and I thought to myself, this might be the opportunity for me to write that sequel to Frank Graham's New York Yankees, which was published about 1947, 48, something like that. So I went downstairs and knocked on the door. In those days, you could actually knock on the door of the trade book editor, the guy in charge. His name was Nick Dincheco, and he said, come in, and I pitched what I wanted to do, to write a book on those Yankees. And believe it or not, he gave me a contract to do it. $2,500 he gave me. So.
You were probably in seventh heaven.
It was truly amazing. And what was even more amazing was I went to Yankee Stadium, which at the time, was owned by Mike Burke, who had worked for CBS. This was the fall of 1972. Marty Appel was the assistant PR guy, and I said to Marty, do you think I could do research here on the Yankees for this book of mine? And he said, of course. And so they'd go out to lunch, and every once in a while, I'd answer the phone, New York Yankees. I mean, I was there for several months doing research. So at the end of the several months research, I sit down to write this book, only to discover you can't write a book using newspaper articles. You can't write anything new. It's all old.
It's history.
Old stuff.
You got to create new content, right?
So I said to myself, I've got to go and visit every single one of these Yankees. Mickey Mantle, Whitey Ford, Roger Maris, you name it. I got to go see these guys.
Life is tough. You get to go meet all those Hall of Famers.
Well, I had to go back to Nick Dincheco, ask him for another $2,500.
Travel expenses.
He could have said no. He gave it to me. And off I went. 33,000 miles of traveling around the country to see these guys. And it took me 2 years. I'll tell you about some of them in a minute, because I've got a book out right now which has got the interviews of some of them. So Dynasty was the first one. And among the people I interviewed for Dynasty was Billy Martin, who was the manager of the Texas Rangers at the time.
I remember Billy's stint there.
Okay. So I interviewed Billy. I put what he had to say in the book. And I wrote myself, I said, Billy Martin was just as important to the Yankees of that time as Mickey Mantle and Whitey Ford. And then I went to work. When this book was written, I went to work for the Bergen Record, Hackensack, New Jersey. My intention was to be a newspaper journalist. I was going to be an editor, and I was on my way to that.
In sports?
No.
No, okay.
No.
You would have missed your passion, though.
Well, I don't know. News is news. I never looked at sports as anything different than regular news. It was just, you know, guys playing games. But the news is still the news. At any rate, I'm working at the Record, and I got a telephone call. It was Billy Martin's agent. You want to write a book with Billy? I said, are you kidding? Of course I want to write a book with Billy. So we agreed to do that. And then a couple weeks later, he said, you know, Billy is, he just can't do it right now. He's got other things he has to do. But I have one other client, and his name is Sparky Lyle. And he was the star relief pitcher for the Yankees at the time. He had won the Cy Young Award in 1977. So I said to him, why would anybody have any interest in what Sparky Lyle has to say? Stupid that I am. Anyhow, the agent says, come on down to Fort Lauderdale. Sit with Sparky, talk to him, sit in the clubhouse and see what's what. Which is what I did. It was February of 1978. And I'm sitting there in the clubhouse, and who do I see? Thurman Munson.
God rest his soul.
Greg Nettles. Reggie Jackson. Ron Guidry. Catfish Hunter. Sparky, of course. Billy Martin. Somewhere upstairs is George Steinbrenner. And I thought to myself, if Sparky would keep a diary, this could be one hell of a book. And Sparky agreed to do it.
Well, you could have written a book on each one of the guys you just mentioned.
You could have, but I don't know. It's writing biographies is a hell of a lot more work than writing autobiographies. You know, you do a book with one guy, you're interviewing one guy. You do a biography, as I did with Billy Martin later, you're interviewing 75 guys. It's a hell of a lot of work.
Yeah, doing interviews. On their relationships.
Yeah, you're doing interviews. Exactly right. So anyhow, Sparky and I spent the entire year of 1978. I lived in Englewood. He lived two towns over. And I'd go over to his house, and we'd sit and we'd talk about the events of the day or the week. And we wrote what became the Bronx Zoo. Originally, it was going to be called, what was I going to call it? I'm drawing a blank right now.
Well, the Bronx Zoo was certainly...
Oh, yeah. Well, the Bronx Zoo was a much...
That was ideal.
Was a much better title.
And a great description. I kind of like Wild, High, and Tight, The Life and Death of Billy Martin. That's also a great description, too.
Right.
So the Bronx Zoo.
Exactly right. The Bronx Zoo. And it ended up on the New York Times bestseller list for 26 weeks.
And did Steinbrenner, did he embrace it?
No, are you kidding me?
I didn't think so.
Steinbrenner had can you say shit fit on the air?
No, you can't, but you just did.
Oh. Anyhow, that's what he had, as a matter of fact.
I'm sure.
And of course, at the end of the year, he traded Sparky away to the Texas Rangers, what happened. He let him go.
He certainly probably wasn't, and I've read your book, I loved it, being a Yankee fan, you know, since I was a kid. But I bet you got a lot of flack about that.
See, I don't get the flack. Sparky gets the flack.
you're just putting the pen to paper.
I'm just doing the work. Yeah, no. What I didn't realize at the time is before the season, Sparky was, as I said, the Cy Young Award winner in 1977. After the season, George goes and buys Goose Gossage.
Yeah, I met Goose up at Clearwater a couple years ago.
And they gave Goose a contract for $2 million.
Big bucks.
Sparky was making $140,000 at the time. And Sparky was angry.
You think? Just a little bit of a delta.
Angry. And so Sparky, bless his soul, had no problem reporting what was actually going on. You know, the battle between Billy and Reggie, whatever was going on at the time. And also some wonderful, wonderful stories. The one that I enjoyed the most was that Thurman Munson had a pistol, and he wanted to buy something to put the pistol in so he could put it around his waist, sort of a waistband for the pistol.
A holster?
A holster. So Thurman puts the money in the envelope and says, you know, waist size 35. Well, Sparky and the other boys go and get the thing and open it up, and they write waist size 55 and seal back up the envelope, send it out. 2 weeks later, the holster comes in, Thurman puts it on, and of course it's so huge, it's hilarious, and all the guys are just laughing like crazy.
He's madder than hell.
He's madder than hell. So puts the holster back in, sends it back out. The boys come and get it, and this time they write waist size 20. So 2 weeks later, the thing comes back. Thurman tries it on. It doesn't go halfway around him. And now he's absolutely
human,
fit to be tied. But to hear Sparky tell that story, I must have laughed for 20 minutes.
You know the unique thing, we're talking to Peter Gombach, of course, we're down here at Ferg Sports Bar and Grill on the Tampa St. Pete Sports Connection Radio Network, and we're taking a trip back in time with his wonderful books that he's written on the New York Yankees, the bulk of them. And it's amazing with, you know, the Bronx Zoo and that era, with all the drama, they're that successful. I mean, that just is a testament to leadership, I guess, from Billy being able to juggle all the personalities and the tensions, right?
Well, I mean, Reggie was really the reason for so much of the tension. Reggie was the same way when he was with the Oakland A's. He was always battling other people. Reggie wanted to be the center of attention. And he was a spectacular Hall of Fame ball player, don't get me wrong.
He still does.
Oh, but his ego was such that he, you know, you had three people on that team who wanted the headlines. George Steinbrenner was a narcissist, no two ways about it. More than anything, George wanted his name in the paper every single day. Billy Martin felt that he was the leader of the Yankees, that it was his New York Yankees. And Reggie Jackson felt the same way. So you've got
three enormous egos.
Three enormous egos battling out. And it was a lot of fun to sit and watch this tension.
But Peter,
day by day,
wouldn't the guy that writes the checks be the one that wins in the long run? And he typically did.
I'm not sure that that's true. I'm not sure.
I'm asking you, I'm
no.
an outsider.
Well,
but George was not stupid at the same time. He, you know,
well, don't forget, there was a 20-year period when he was the owner and they never won a pennant. George was a guy who traded away rookie prospects, you know, Willie McGee on Seinfeld. Who was it they traded away where George Costanza's father said to the Steinbrenner character?
Yeah, who was that?
It's Seattle outfielder. How could you trade so-and-so?
It wasn't Griffey, was it?
No. He was a Yankee rookie who he traded away.
Yeah, I can't think of that.
George was not the perfect owner, believe me.
No, without a shadow of a doubt. But then he had incredible success, of course, in the 90s.
Well, he had success two times.
Yep.
And both of those successes came after he was suspended from baseball for 2 years. Both of those times.
I had forgotten that.
Yeah, the first time he was suspended for giving illegal money to the President Nixon campaign. So he was out 2 years. And during those 2 years, Gabe Paul built that baseball team. And so those were the winning teams in 76 and 77, 78 and 81. Those were Gabe Paul's winning team. Okay? So George comes back and decides, trades all these young kids away and doesn't win for 20 years. And then what does he do? He gets in a big fight with his outfielder, Dave Winfield.
I remember Dave Winfield.
He and Winfield had a contract where Winfield was to get a cost of living raise. And George didn't realize it was in the contract. And he took it personally and decided he was going to do everything he could. He wanted to get rid of Winfield, but he couldn't do it because Winfield had a no-trade clause in his contract. He said terrible things about Winfield in the newspapers, but Winfield didn't care. So what happens is a guy named Harry Spira, who worked for Winfield, came to George and said, look, I know things about Winfield that you want to know, and I want $100,000 for that information.
Oh, okay? My God. This is
So George gave him $60,000 to start and started saying all these terrible things about Winfield. Well, George wouldn't pay Spira the other 40. So Spira, you know, made it public that George had paid him for this terrible
Oh, my God, that created this an absolute mess.
So the commissioner suspends George for 2 years.
Again, I'd forgotten those two suspensions.
And after that suspension, Stick Michael was the general manager. He had five rookies at the time. He had Jeter. He had Bernie Williams. He had Andy Pettit, Mariano Rivera, and their wonderful catcher. What's his name? The catcher of that era. And anyhow, they had those five guys. George was going to trade away most of them. Because George was suspended, he didn't get to trade him away. And by the time he came back, those guys were the
nucleus of the success.
They were the heart of the success of those Yankees in the late 1990s and the 2000s.
And then, of course, Joe Torre at the helm. And I thought that, you know, I think I mentioned to you, Jeff Mangold, who was the strength and conditioning coach during that era,
uh-huh.
is a good friend of mine from
yep.
my hometown. And I was blessed to be able to take my sons over here in 99, 2000. And at that time, it was Legends Field, as
sure.
you're well aware of.
Sure.
And they got to meet Gede, and it was just a thrill for my son, my
Absolutely.
Own son. And actually, I just ran into Bernie Williams this past year down on Sunset Beach.
No kidding.
He's an accomplished bass player.
Yes, he is.
He has a Latin Grammy. He'd been at Ruth Eckert Hall on Sunday night. My friend right behind us, Sherry, got a hold of me. I live 300 paces, basically, from this little tiki bar.
Yep.
He was down there on the Monday night jamming.
Wow.
And I talked to him briefly. I didn't want to bother, you know.
Sure.
But I said, hey, my good friend Manny Mangold, and he said, oh, yeah, we had a nice conversation. It was great to see him. But all those guys, Joe Torre was a master as well.
Let me tell you about Torre.
Billy Martin, but Joe was
about
kind of a master.
Torre had a father who abused him.
Really?
Torre's father was abusive. So Torre knew how to handle abusive people. Steinbrenner was an abusive person. Torre knew, unlike Billy, that if you wanted to criticize Steinbrenner, you went in the room, just the two of you, and you closed the door so that nobody could hear what you were saying. That's how Torre managed the last 8-9 years with the Yankees. He never once criticized Steinbrenner in the papers or on the radio or TV. Never once. And that's how he maintained it. Even though Steinbrenner...
He's abusive to everybody.
Abusive to everybody. Absolutely abusive to everybody. Terrible.
You know, I do hear stories in this area, but again, it makes sense talking to you, Peter. He wanted his name on everything. You've got George Steinbrenner High School. You've
That's
got
right.
all these fields.
That's right.
So it wasn't completely if I could use the term properly, philanthropy on his part. It was his ego.
Always. No, that's exactly right. Exactly right.
So through all your interviews, in fact, did you interview Roger Maris for... The great years?
Well, I'll tell you a story about that.
Did you have to go to North Dakota?
No. He was in Gainesville.
Was he really?
I was in Englewood, New Jersey. He was in Gainesville, Florida. As you know, after Roger finished his career with the Yankees, he was traded to
St. Louis,
and he helped St. Louis win pennants in 1967 and 1968. So for Dynasty, I certainly wanted to interview Roger Maris, and so... I sent him letters, I called on the phone, nothing. I went to his office at the beer distributorship.
And say he made a lot of money in the beer distributorship.
He did very well. And so it was clear, Roger was, he was really angry with the Yankees. He was incredibly angry at the way Ralph Houck treated him. So I thought, well, okay, I wasn't able to interview DiMaggio either. He avoided me as well. So maybe I won't get to interview Roger. So the next person I went to see was Cleet Boyer, who lived in Atlanta.
I forgot about Cleet Boyer.
Cleet had the Golden Glove Restaurant in Atlanta. So Cleet said to me, I'll meet you at 9 o'clock in the morning. Come to the restaurant, and I'll sit and talk to you there. So I show up at 9 o'clock in the morning, and then it becomes 11 o'clock, and then 1 o'clock in the afternoon, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 6 o'clock in the evening. Fleet showed up.
You're a persistent man,
well,
Peter.
Yeah. What are you going to do? He said he'd meet me, so I sat and waited for him. He showed up at 9 o'clock at night, and he showed up with Roger Maris.
Oh, my.
Roger and Cleet were closest of friends. Cleet was on his way to Japan to play in his last year of baseball. He needed the $1 million the Japanese were giving him. So anyhow, Cleet says to Roger and me, sit down, I'll be over in a few minutes. And I'm sitting across from Roger at this table, and, you know, hi, how are you, that sort of thing. And I was afraid to say to Roger, you know, can I interview you, for fear that he'd say no. But about 2 minutes later, Roger said to me, do you want to go outside and talk? And I said, yes. And I have my little pocket tape recorder, and we talked for an hour and 15 minutes, and he unloaded his heart. It was so interesting, that anger that he had for the way he was treated on the Yankees was amazing. That even the year when he hit the 61 home runs in 1961, he really had no support from anybody. Nobody. He was on his own.
That's sad.
Well, and he was a very private person. By the end of the year, he was losing his hair. His hair was falling out. The pressure was so great. But even after doing that, he played several more years. In 1966, he was sliding home, and he caught his hand on the umpire's spikes and broke his hand. And the Yankees took x-rays, did not tell him his hand was broken. And he
can you imagine in today's world?
Yeah.
Oh, my word.
I know it. But they needed him, because the Yankees were in the cellar at the time in 66, and they wanted him to draw fans. And so there was that. At the end of the 66 season, Roger told me, he told Ralph Houck, the general manager, I'm going to retire. It's time for me to step down. That's enough. And Houck said to him, how about waiting until the spring? Wait till the spring and we'll throw you a classy send-off. So Roger said, yeah, you know, what difference does it make? Okay, fine. And 2 weeks later, Ralph Houck traded him to the St. Louis Cardinals.
What a, I tell you what, as much as I, you know, grew up loving the Yankees and passionate about it, and I'm not a bandwagon rider, when I hear these stories from you, Peter, it makes me wonder, you know, how naive a lot of us Yankee fans were to how vicious the organization was really, really run.
Well, the joy of doing what I do is that the only way you can find out what's really going on is by interviewing the players. You know, I've got a, I might as well plug my
book.
Yeah,
of course. Anything you want to do here.
Well, okay, I got it. I have a book coming out March 15th called Whispers of the Gods. And these are some of the best interviews. These are the full interviews. So, for instance, with Roger Maris, I used a paragraph here and a paragraph there in Dynasty. But these are the complete interviews with people. Jim Bouton, Roger Maris, Roy Campanella, Tom Sturdivant, Ted Williams, Stan Musial. Just a whole slew of these wonderful people.
Whispers of the Gods, tales from baseball's golden age, told by the men who played it. And as they say, who better than out of the horse's mouth?
Yeah.
And you're able to extract these guys. And obviously, Peter, they have a lot of confidence in you. They have a lot of confidence in you to open up like that.
Well, I think that the key to it is that you have to show them that you care, and you have to show them that you've done your homework. So if the first couple of questions that you ask, you know, when you were in Class C, you hit, you know, 394 and you had a really great manager, you know, something like that, to let them see that you actually did your homework to find out something about them. And they say, okay, this guy's legitimate, I'll talk to him.
Well, obviously, you've done your homework for decades and are extremely successful. I've got to ask you a question about Phil Rizzuto. I worked for the Cubs organization for almost 3 years in AAA in the Iowa Cubs. And I was blessed to spend three or four occasions with Ronnie Santo, and I actually crashed Harry
Carey. Ron Santo is in here.
I see that.
Yeah.
And I'll have to get that book. And I was fortunate to sit with Ronnie and my sons when they were young kids, and they just loved him.
Oh, he's a wonderful, wonderful person, Ron Santo.
And
volatile. I have to tell you, I was at a Cubs fantasy camp as I was doing my book, Wrigleyville. That's where I interviewed Ron
Santo. Were you down in Mesa?
Yes, I was down in Mesa. And he's sitting across the table from me, and I mentioned my affection for Billy Martin. And I don't know what came over him, but he started to reach over the table to grab me by the throat.
That cracks me up, man. Oh, my God. Well, you hit some kind of a nerve there, Peter. You got Ronnie coming at you. Yeah, I crashed Harry Carey's funeral February of 1998, and that's the last time I actually had a short conversation with him. And I went to Harry Carey's back in December. My girlfriend and my daughter, and brought some memories back. Because believe it or not, Dutchie Carey is still alive.
And she is.
She's 91 years old.
Wow.
She still drives, and she still has a vodka when she gets to Harry Carey's. And so that was a great story. But I loved Ronnie's color analysis. And those were the great days. And you probably interviewed a lot of those guys. Of the play-by-play guys and the color guys, the way that they painted a picture.
They were the best.
Those two together.
They were the best.
Was like a comedy duo.
Steve Stone and Harry Carey.
I love Stoney. They screwed him. The Cubs organization screwed Stoney.
They did. Well, you change ownership and this is what happens.
Yeah.
It's what happens. I dedicated my Wrigleyville book in part to Harry Carey. He had me on prior to one of the games. It was wonderful.
I bet that was just a thrill.
Oh, he was one of the greatest.
You know, and I'm a big fan, you know, and I'm sure the same way. I love listening to baseball. I
sure
still do.
Oh,
and the guys
absolutely.
Down here do a great
they
job.
They do a wonderful
they
job.
They do a superb
yes,
job.
Yes, they
I've got
do.
Got their pictures over there.
Yep.
But anyway, when Pat Hughes and Ronnie, and I was listening all the time then because I was still working with the organization, and you know how he'd stumble, fumble, and bumble more than I do, Ronnie, and he was trying to make a point about Sammy Sosa. And he says, Pat, who's out in left field? Like, that's Sammy Sosa, Pat, Ronnie. And he'd have to correct him. But Pat Hughes was just smooth with the way that Ronnie would butcher things.
Uh-huh.
And they were a nice duo as well.
Sure. Sure. Well, we had in New York, we had Mel Allen, we had Phil Rizzuto, then we had Phil Rizzuto and Bill White.
Oh, really?
I didn't
know that combo.
Oh, and they were a fabulous combination as well. Phil Rizzuto, I was driving on the New Jersey Turnpike one day, and Phil Rizzuto was talking about the conversation he had with the Statue of Liberty.
Was he drunk?
No, Phil never drank. No, he was just Phil. I mean, it was hilarious, and he's in this book too, Phil Rizzuto.
Had a conversation with the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah.
Well, back in my days of imbibing, I probably had a few conversations with a few statues, or I thought there was a statue there, but that was in my youth. And I know it's tough to pinpoint. We're talking to, and I'm going to call you just, you know, probably one of the leading authors in baseball history of all time, Peter Gallenbach. A favorite or a unique interview that comes to the forefront?
Well, my favorite interview for Dynasty was with Mickey Mantle, of course.
God rest his soul.
Mickey Mantle, you should see what my office looks like. It's a shrine to Mickey Mantle. But every Yankee fan loved him. I mean, the way the Yankee fans loved Babe Ruth in the 20s, so the Yankee fans in the 50s and 60s really loved Mickey Mantle, like he was part of your family.
The man.
We hit like him. When I was a kid, I was a switch hitter because he was a switch hitter. You know, I ran in the same manner that he ran.
Just not as fast.
Not as fast. Not as powerful. So I called Mickey. He said, yeah, I'll be home in Dallas. Come. You know, give me a call. So I landed at the Dallas airport, and I call his home. And his wife answered. I said, can I speak to Mickey, please? And she says to me, he's in New York. Okay. So I got on a plane, flew back to New York the next day, was in the Yankee clubhouse, and there's Mickey Mantle. Okay, I'm going to interview Mickey. And I was too cowed to actually do it. So I went over to Elston Howard, who I had already interviewed, and I said, Ellie, would you do me a favor?
Ellie was a player then.
Oh, he was a catcher, yeah.
He eventually became a coach.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, he was not a player then. He had to have been a coach.
Yeah,
he had to have been a coach. This was 1973.
Okay, gotcha.
So he was a coach with the Yankees. So I went over to Ellie and I said, you know, would you introduce me to Mickey, please? And Ellie, the sweetest guy in the world.
You don't seem like a shy guy. But
it's one instance? Never happened before.
You're meeting Mick, number seven.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. When I played for Camp Winocky, I was number seven, believe you me.
And for a reason.
That's right. So Ellie walks me over to Mickey and says, Mickey, this is this guy. How do you do? We shake hands. I said, Mick, can I talk to you for a few minutes? And Mickey looks me in the eye and he goes, no. And he bursts out laughing. He had me for a minute on his no. And then I proceeded to interview him for about an hour, and it was wonderful because Mickey had retired in 1968. This was 1973, so he was 5 years out of the game, and terribly, terribly missing playing. I mean, his whole life was baseball, and he's telling me how he's having nightmares at night. He says, I'm standing outside of Yankee Stadium, and I can hear the PA announcer saying, now batting in the third position, number seven, Mickey Mantle. And he's saying to me, and I can't find the door to get into the stadium.
Oh, my.
And I wake up in a cold sweat, and it's horrifying. It was really something. I mean, Mickey, who was one of the greatest players of all time, he had been abused by his father. He was abused in a way by Casey Stengel.
Grew up in Oklahoma.
He was son of a miner. And he got so strong because as a kid, as a teen, he would go into the mines with a sledgehammer and sledgehammer the rocks.
Mickey Mantle did?
He certainly did. And that's how he became so powerful. I went to Mickey's hometown to see the house that he grew up in.
Was that Edmonton?
No, Commerce.
Commerce?
Commerce, Oklahoma. Yeah. I mean, they lived in such poverty. But his father was convinced that to get out of poverty, that Mickey was going to be a great baseball player. And this time, the father turned out to be right, of course. And the father is the one who made him into a switch hitter.
We're talking to Peter Gollenbach right here on the Tampa St. Pete Sports Connection Radio Network, and he wrote the book, Seven, the Mickey Mantle novel.
Yep.
And one thing, I have a good friend, Randy Grimes, and Randy played for the Tampa Bay Bucks, and he's got an organization, Athletes in Addiction. He's from Tyler, Texas. And one of the things that he, before Mickey's passing, he did find out that Mickey said after he came out of rehabilitation,
yep,
that was his greatest success.
It's true.
In life.
It's true.
Is that true?
No.
Well, not that I would doubt Randy.
Yeah, no.
It gives me goosebumps.
Oh, it's absolutely true. Mickey had no self-respect. Like I told you, he was abused by his father. He was abused by Casey Stengel. He could never understand why people loved him the way they loved him. Because he didn't love himself.
And that's why...
And the alcoholism came from that feeling.
Well, and you know, a lot of, doesn't matter what sport, we see this with a lot of athletes, that once they leave, and you said how he was struggling in these nightmares,
yeah,
they go out to the taverns, they go out to the clubs, and they're revered, and they sit, and people want to hear, just like the old Bruce Springsteen song, Glory Days,
yeah,
they want to hear Mick recount what they saw on television, or I heard on the radio. Tell us, Mick. And he wants to relive it, and that's how they do it.
Well, Mickey was usually so in the bag that he would sit in the corner and people would leave him alone.
Really?
Yeah.
Sad.
It was terrible. Well, and then, as you said, he went and got himself sober, and shortly thereafter he developed the cancer. So he wasn't alive. He wasn't alive for very long.
No.
After that.
All right. Well, I'm going to have you back on here in the future if you would be so kind, especially when baseball starts again. You got any prediction as a man that's got his finger on the pulse of baseball? Do you think that they will come to some resolution? So that
I do think that they will. They settled on something yesterday,
which is amazing.
Something, you know, and they can't be that stupid. They could be, but I would like to think that they won't be. I mean, baseball right now is kind of at a crossroads.
Without a shadow of a doubt.
You've got kids under 30 who are playing esports and who don't give a damn about anything that's really going on.
Or soccer.
And then there's soccer, of course.
Yes.
And we're not getting any younger.
Yeah, us baseball fans.
Yeah.
Well, I want to get you back. Maybe we'll do this the weekend of opening day.
Sounds like fun.
Down here, and we'll continue these conversations because we could do 3-4 hours, you and I.
Yeah, I guess we could.
All right. Thank you very much. He's Peter Gollenbach. He was kind enough to come down here to Ferg's and join me. And I'm going to see if I can pull this one off. I've got Ray Kennedy with me. Ray, are you there, my man?
Yeah, Mike, can you hear me?
I can't believe that with my buffoonery technology, I actually pulled this off, buddy.
It's hard. It's not easy.
Yeah,
for you.
Yeah.
I'm listening to that gentleman finish up. And, you know, true story, Mickey Mantle was in on the Pat Summerall.
I
talked with the producer 17 years with the John Madden show, and he told me how Pat Summerall had a really big drinking problem. Mickey Mantle actually was in on that when he sat in with him, and they had an intervention meeting to get Pat Summerall on a clean and sober road, and it worked. And of course, we saw how much that meant to all football fans for all the years of Pat Summerall and John Madden.
Well, yeah, and I'm certain it appears where that story also with Mickey and Pat Summerall.
Talk to him again.
Yeah, and that's what Randy Grimes told us. So where are you at today in this beautiful Saturday out here in Tampa Bay? Of course, we've got the Firestone St. Pete Grand Prix down there at the pier, just 13 blocks away from here. So you're out and about getting your finger on the pulse of Tampa Bay.
Yes. I'll tell you what, Mike, I got down to Ferg's last night, did a little cup of Ray there on Bucks Report, and I saw the Italian families, French families, international families from all over the world that are in town for this huge event, which is the IndyCar, the Grand Prix, the St. Pete Grand Prix. And I'll tell you what, this evening I'll be down there. They got a big concert going on tonight, but then, you know, I challenge anyone out there in St. Petersburg, and I'm sure most of our residents in the fine borough already know this and probably do this, but I love to go walk down for sunrise along the race course and race day. It's just something about it. And it's, with this weather we've been having, with the highs in the mid-80s, but in the evenings, the humidity is so low. Why not congregate down there and celebrate an international stage event like the St. Pete Grand Prix and then come up to Ferg's and watch it and be there for the post-party because it gets great.
It certainly does get crazy. And, you know, I was just talking to Peter about the Rays, and today's news, it looks like the earliest, I can't see this happening, the earliest that spring training or even games will be started would be March 8th, and that's if they get things pinned down today and tomorrow, and Monday.
And Mike, you know, it kills me. I'm at Walsingham Park with my daughter, nice, beautiful classmates. We're at that safer place where we can have birthday parties again. But across the water is the Seminole Junior Warhawk Athletic Association. I played baseball there 100 years ago, and I remember I heard the cheers all of a sudden come up loud and across the water about 5 minutes ago. I just posted on my, go to my Facebook page. I just posted it 5 minutes ago. Opening day cheers. It took me back to when the Brooks spikes went on, and you put on you put on your stirrups and you put on your pants and that the butterflies as you went out on the field between each inning, and I posed that the butterflies last all the way through the major league. But you see this with the stoppage and the owners and the players, and I blame the owners more than anything else. Everyone's trying to draw that line in the sand, but at the end of the day, this is the time of year. This is what spring is made for. This is what Al Lang, the mayor of the city of St. Petersburg in 1918, posed when he brought spring baseball to St. Petersburg. This is what you're supposed to do. Pitchers and catchers get here, get warmed up, and get the season started on time. I hate to see it starting late. We went through it with the pandemic and tried to do it with the whole bubble thing. We're supposed to be starting true and through this year, so they've got to fix this and get it going, but I hate to see the fact it's going to be late.
Yeah, unfortunately, and, you know, you love your Rays. I've fallen in love with them, and after listening to Peter talk about my New York Yankees and their ruthless inside stories, I might have to go back to my days with the Cubs, and that would be my NL team, and my AL team will be the Rays, brother.
Yes. I'll tell you, Mike, this is what I posed last night. I did a little cup of Ray down there, like I mentioned. And St. Petersburg, the city is, people are trying to tell me that if you build a stadium in East Tampa or you build it into Ybor City and you got to get through Malfunction Junction during the week at rush hour, don't tell me that's easier. You got PSTA building the travel lines from the beaches to the bay, up First Avenue South and down First Avenue North. You're going to be able to get from Tradewinds to the bay to the $90 million pier within 17 and a half minutes. Sternberg gets 50% of the development rights if the Rays are in town in 2027. Then that means all 80 acres just behind Ferg's there in the Edge District of St. Petersburg. He's got to make a way to make this thing work. Get a nice indoor stadium built there, a little bit smaller of a footprint. Keep baseball in St. Petersburg. I don't mean to start a trend for it. I mean, they're going to make their, you know, they're going to take, Sternberg's going to take his ball and do what he wants to do, but there's a fiscal way to do it. There's a financial way to do it. I don't mean that Sternberg turns into Jeffrey Pinnock and develops down there. Like, if the St. Pete's not going to let him do it, because St. Petersburg's got a lot more property and value than the old Tampa Port. But got to keep baseball here. I want to see the Rays. Got to stay in Tampa Bay. But first and foremost, let's make it St. Pete.
I agree with you 1,000%. But time will tell. 2027 is the end of this contract. However, it takes about 3.5 years to build a stadium, so they've got to get off the schneid, my friend.
Yeah, and the Rays bought the Rowdies 3 years ago, which buying the Rowdies from Edwards, the developer, means that the Rays also bought Al Lang Field. And again, Mayor Al Lang, 1918, brings Major League Baseball to spring down here in Florida because he realizes the climate we have is the perfect place for pitchers and catchers to warm their arms up and get ready for the season. They have Al Lang Field. You build a stadium down there and tilt the outfield just right. You got a glass wall along the outfield. You can see the $100 million pier. You can see a Dolly Museum. You can see Al Quitted Airport plane landing. And you can build it there. With the travel system and infrastructure the city of St. Pete and PSDA is putting in, it works. People in Tampa are always going to complain about coming over here. But you know something? Also over here, we know why it's better on this side of Pinellas County, because we got the beaches, we got the bay, and we got the St. Pete Sports Connection here live from Ferg's every Saturday, brother.
Thank you. Hey, let's do a plug for yourself, and then next week I'll get you down here on the air with me, and I got a jam show for next week and some content, but I'll make sure I leave a good 20 minutes for you and I, 25 minutes, and put that segment in there.
Do me a favor. If you're up and about in the morning, I know you're a night owl too, so you get out and you're enjoying the town, but if you're up and about, you know, hit me up and come on down. See me. We'll have a cup of coffee on the racetrack down there before things get crazy. Start of the race at 12:30 tomorrow. People watch it. I'm on Bucks Report. I got Cup of Ray. I'm down here at Ferg every time I get a chance, and I'm on the St. Pete Sports Connection with Mr. Mike Rickard, brother. Thanks for having me.
All right, my friend. I look forward to it. I may take you up tomorrow morning. I've been pushing my old carcass. I don't have to do a two-minute sports update until Monday morning, so maybe I'll get up tomorrow and enjoy that. I see a lot of sunsets, but I'd like to see a sunrise or two on the east side of this great place that we live. All right, my man, have a great time.
Yes.
Great time with your daughter. Family first, as I always say.
You know it, brother, and I'll talk to you later. Take care.
All right, that's Ray Kennedy, and he's kind enough to be a big part now of the growth of the Tampa St. Pete Sports Connection and the direction we're going with FergSportsConnection.tv. You can go right now to MyHoovie.tv, and you'll be able to click on our website. The archives are there, RadioSt.Pete.com. And Big Ed, kind enough up north to always, I didn't realize this until today, they always record on the TantalkRadio.com. They record the podcast and the radio, so looking forward to that as well. For the Eckerd women's soccer team, and for Pete Gollenbach and Ray Kennedy, Joe Berdrow and Big Ed on the controls, I'm Mike Rickard. Thank you for listening to the Tampa St. Pete Sports Connection.
WTAN, Clearwater.
FM 106.1.
WDCF, Dade City.
FM 102.3.
WZHR, Zephyr Hills.
FM 104.3.
Listen.